I would like to introduce now David Krakauer. He is at the Santa Fe Institute. He's a scientist there. Welcome, David, to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. You've got five people, you and four other fellows at the Santa Fe Institute, talking about areas like infectious disease, ecological systems, social systems, the economy, all in the context of Darwin, who's been with us now, whose theories have been with us now for well over a century. So, first of all, the theory of evolution. Let's talk in very basic terms. What is a theory? What is a scientific theory?
Well, in some sense, a theory tries to account for regularities in nature. So, typically empirical regularities. And you try to derive some set of propositions or statements based on some mechanisms that can account for the empirical regularities, which go beyond a straight description.
So, so that is sort of scientific sounding. What's an example? What are some examples of scientific theories? I mean, the reason I'm asking this is because there has been in the media kind of a wrong-headed set of statements like evolution is just a theory. Just a theory doesn't really make sense when you talk about a scientific theory. What are some other theories?
Right. So just a theory for us is a compliment. Because as scientists, we thrive in conditions of uncertainty. In some sense, the whole debate about religion versus science is a false dichotomy. These are two different modes of appreciating the world. The real dichotomy is between those who enjoy and appreciate uncertainty and try to solve mysteries, and those who want to live in permanent certainty. So theories are just theories. They're not the final answer. If they were, we wouldn't have jobs. So a theory really is a disciplined, empirical means of trying to understand some phenomenon. Most theories, by definition, are wrong. They quickly come to be outdated because a better theory comes along or a new observation comes along that refutes the theory. So to say something is a theory is not an insult. So a good theory, for example, would be Newton's theory of gravitation. So you have this regular orbit of the planets. You have an apple that falls off a tree. And all of them can be explained using the same rather simple set of mathematical equations. Now, the theory makes all sorts of assumptions that we know fundamentally are not true. So now, with general relativity in the 1910s and teens, and with quantum mechanics in the 1920s, we know that fundamentally Newton's theories cannot be mechanistically correct. However, at the scale that Newton sought to explain the universe and explain the world, the theory is incredibly accurate. It helped us to get lunar landers onto the moon. And so a theory really does provide us with both a means of organizing data and predicting new phenomena, what we'd call out of sample, where we don't have observations. But of course, we accept and we want those theories to be wrong because we want to keep ourselves employed.
You want them to be wrong. It's not just because you want to keep yourselves employed. It's because you're always searching for a better and more accurate explanation for things.
Of course, of course. But I think that the... let me just make two remarks. I mean, most people understand that Darwin had a great theory, Newton had a great theory, Einstein had a great theory. But I think most people believe a great theory is an idea that explains something that formerly we had completely failed to understand. Allows you to organize empirical data in new ways. Which is true, and it's a very important part of a theory. But the second, perhaps more important part of a theory, and that it's the part that scientists know about but many other people tend to neglect, is that theories generate new ideas. They generate new uncertainties.
New questions.
Right, they're a baseline. They give us a new baseline for asking new questions. And that's almost the more important part of a theory, that it's what you could call generative. It reveals new mysteries, hopefully solvable mysteries, that allow us to investigate new properties of the world that were hitherto, without the lens of the old theory, invisible.
So when you speak, one gets the sense, I get the sense of a little human flashlight mm-hmm. pointing on the whole world potential knowledge, and there's more and more light, but there's always so much that we still don't know, and the more we know, the more is revealed, but we never get to an end point.
No, that's right. So, I mean, yes, think about a good theory as flashing a small light in an area of darkness. And a small flashlight produces a small circle of light, has a small circumference, and if you step out of the light, you step into the local darkness, areas that you haven't yet understood. But a great theory, say Newton's theories or Darwin's theories, are like beaming a huge headlight into the darkness. So, one, you reveal a huge amount of detail that the flashlight did not reveal, but you also now have a much larger circumference to step out of into the unknown, and so a much larger boundary into uncertainty. So they do both, right? So great theories illuminate more of the unknown, but they also provide a platform for exploring, in a disciplined fashion, more of the unknown.
It strikes me also that they allow you to actually do things that you weren't able to do before. It's not just intellectual. Newton's theories of physics allowed you to build skyscrapers and, as you say, land a lunar module and do all sorts of things that you couldn't have done without them. So it's quite practical. And in the same way, Darwin's evolutionary theory allows you to develop all sorts of antibiotics and things like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can... It's a practical, functional set of tools.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, people forget that about the Darwinian theory. It's not just a way of looking at the world. It provides new means of interacting with the world. At tonight's lectures, in fact, we'll cover several of the modern applications of a modified Darwinian theory. We'll explore, for example, Tanmoy Bhattacharya. We'll explore issues of disease, how we've improved, hugely improved, our understanding of HIV and its spread in populations, and how we might develop vaccines based on a fundamental understanding of the evolutionary dynamics of viruses and the immune system. Another area, of course, is in linguistic or historical reconstruction. The Darwinian framework provides us with a set of tools for reconstructing our ancestors, both our physical ancestors and our cultural ancestors, through language. So it provides us with a whole set of mathematical and computational tools for answering empirical questions that we couldn't answer before.
So what does Darwin's theory of evolution explain that had not been explained before?
Well, it might be worth just reviewing a little bit of the history of Darwin, just to get us along the path. I mean, so Darwin was born in Victorian England. He was born in 1809. He went to Edinburgh to study medicine. His father, Robert Darwin, had been a physician, and like a dutiful fifth son, he was the fifth of six children, he felt he ought to follow in his father's footsteps. But Darwin couldn't stand the sight of blood. He was a very delicate sensibility, and this was a time when surgery was conducted without anaesthetic. So Darwin dropped out of medical school, and he went to Cambridge to become a member of the clergy, which is an irony on reflection. And he studied there and got to know a man called John Henslow, who was a professor of botany, who was very taken by Charles, took him on long walks. They went beetle hunting together and did a lot of natural history, and eventually introduced Charles to the captain of the Beagle, Fitzroy. And Darwin spent the years 1831 to 1836 on a voyage, charting the contours of the South American continent, taking longitudinal measurements. And that voyage changed his life. He saw things that he never would have seen in England, geologies, huge, weird species, fossil remains. And that was really his education. And it wasn't Edinburgh, it wasn't Cambridge, it was a voyage.
And it's a very interesting question of whether, I mean, England is full of species. There's little bugs and leaves and things, that, you know, trees and animals on the coastline and everywhere. But it took seeing these much more dramatic examples to spark something inside of this scientist.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, Victorian England was fascinated by evolutionary concepts. They didn't have Darwin's evolutionary concept, but they had others. And it had been explored in detail by naturalists. So every beetle had been named, every tree had been dissected and taken apart. Whereas most of the academics of the Victorian Britain had never left the country. And so Darwin, this young boy, was able to provide them with specimens and huge numbers of new species, in which were written, you know, several monographs, very significant monographs. So he was, in addition to being this great theorist, was actually a collector and provider of specimens for the great scientists of his time.
So looking at the, you know, back to the headlight metaphor, you've got all these zillions of species that are collected by people, and then he has shown a light on them in a different way, allowing you to see them in a different way. What was that difference?
Well, it's interesting. So Darwin, so he's on this voyage of the Beagle. He's reading Milton, Paradise Lost. He's reading the great first volume of the Principles of Geology written by Charles Lyell, one of the great so-called uniformitarian geologists, evolutionary geologists. This was a geology that questioned the biblical account of the Earth, said that the Earth didn't arise in a series of catastrophes, but uniformly and slowly. And it was slowly shaping his mind. So he gets to the Galapagos and he sees these tortoises, and this was in 1835, sees these finches, and he thinks they all look similar. There seems to be some connection between these species, because you have to understand, or your listeners should understand, that at the time, most scientists believed that all species were created at the beginning of time, simultaneously.
So one by the hand of God?
By God. So species didn't arise from species. They've all been there forever. In fact, Thomas Jefferson was a great proponent of this idea. And one of the reasons why he funded the Lewis and Clark explorations was to demonstrate that no species had been created and no species had gone extinct. So this is the world that he was born into. And Darwin started to make observations that undermined the credibility of that position. But he wasn't a great observer. In fact, people often talk about the Galapagos finches. Darwin thought they were all totally different species, and it wasn't until he sent them back to his colleague in Cambridge, John Gould, that Gould said, you know, these are all finches. These are all one genus. They're just different variants. So Darwin on the Beagle started to question the orthodox theories of his time. He hadn't yet come up with a theory of natural selection, but he did start to understand that all living forms, were fundamentally related. That is, that everything seemed to have evolved from a common ancestor.
And that is a huge fundamental difference from what had gone before.
No, absolutely. I mean, there were evolutionary theorists, people who believed in transformation of life through time, but they didn't believe that new species could come into existence. So they had observed, for example, through breeding experiments, Darwin's favorite being the pigeon, but all of us have had dogs or cats. We know that we can breed them, but none of us create new species at home. And so there was an evolutionary thinking, what we call now microevolution, but macroevolution, evolutionary processes that could generate new species, that was not something anyone believed in.
And then it caught on, because people examined this, hit their heads and said, oh my God.
Well, of course, Darwin comes back, he hangs out in London, he tells his friends about this great trip that he had and all these great specimens he collected. He starts keeping notes on his ideas. And then in 1858, he gets a letter from Borneo in the Indonesian Galapagos and archipelago. And from Alfred Russel Wallace, who was a collector. He wasn't a gentleman like Darwin. This is a real class-based society. He was out just collecting specimens for gentlemen to analyze back in London. And this letter basically scoops Darwin's theory. It says, you know, I think that organisms are suited to the conditions of existence. It's that there's a correlation between the way organisms look and the environments that they live in. So this is a basic selection principle. And Darwin was terrified because he'd spent, you know, years and years after the Beagle voyage thinking about this. He hadn't published anything because he was terrified of offending his family, offending his friends, most of whom are religious, and out comes this letter from this nobody that's basically scooped him. So he sends the letter to his friend Charles Lyell. He says, what should I do? And he says, well, you guys have to publish together. So in 1858, just before The Origin of Species was published in 1859, there's a joint presentation of this idea, the idea of natural selection. But neither Wallace, who's in Borneo, is there, and Darwin's not there because he's burying one of his dead children. The Darwins had 10 children, two of whom died. And when this is presented, no one even bats an eye, you know, an eyelid. They just think this is an uninteresting idea. And in fact, when the end of the year summary of the Linnaean Society, where this revolutionary idea was presented, was being articulated, the the president of the society said, you know, nothing of any revolutionary significance was published this year.
Isn't that fascinating? There was a poet on the air the other day who wrote a poem about one of the very early Beatles concerts in which people just yawned and didn't realize that this great phenomenon had just taken place.
Yeah, that's right. And so what Darwin then did is he took all of his notes and he wrote The Origin of Species. So the pamphlet that had been read at the Society of Wallace and Darwin just wasn't long enough and wasn't compelling enough to convince the public of its value. But when The Origin of Species came out, which was the book, what Darwin called one long argument, huge amount of empirical detail stacked up to support the idea of evolution through natural selection, it became a huge bestseller, and the first edition completely sold out. It was like a Michael Crichton novel.
And was it controversial?
It was immediately controversial. His good friends, Richard Owen, who was a famous paleontologist who worked on fossils, who invented the idea of homology and analogy, similarity by descent or environment, was horrified. Charles's own wife, Emma Wedgwood, who he relied upon for her insights into his ideas, was terrified. She knew he was doing this, but she remained religious, fairly devout, and in particular in relation to the afterlife, she really did want to have an eternally joyous life after she died, with Charles, one assumes. So his friends were upset, Charles Lyell even was upset. But then many others saw this as the answer to the questions that they'd all been asking. How is it that this divergence and this evolution takes place?
We're talking to David Krakauer of the Santa Fe Institute. Tonight is the lecture, The Post-Darwinian World, in which David Krakauer and four other scientists from the Santa Fe Institute are going to be speaking about various areas of science and what's happening today. So let's go back to the life of Darwin.
Okay, so we had The Origin of Species. So this is a sensation when it's published. And essentially he sets forth this idea of natural selection, the idea that if you have organisms that are variable, that this variability can be inherited, and that there are scarce resources in the world. Then what you expect to happen is that those variants that are better suited to the environment they live in will outproduce those that are worse suited, and that's natural selection. So it's a very simple theory. In fact, when Darwin's friend, Thomas Henry Huxley, heard it, he said, damn, why didn't I think of that? It's so
right.
Obvious. I mean, it's not a complicated idea. But of course, there was controversy. There's a very famous debate that took place at the Museum of Natural History in Oxford with the Bishop of Oxford, Bishop Wilberforce. This is a famous debate took place in 1860. And I know the room where the debate was taking place because one of my mentors on my PhD occupied that room now. It was his office. Wilberforce asked the question. Darwin couldn't be present. At this point, Darwin had retreated to his home. He retreated to his home in the early 1840s. He never came out. And so he was the oracle and sage that you had to visit. And so he was represented by his bulldog, Thomas Henry Huxley. And the archbishop said, on which side of your family are you descended from an ape, your mother or your father's side? And Huxley said to his friend Hooker, God has delivered him into my hands. And he stood up and he said, it's a disgrace that a man of your intelligence and responsibility should lower yourself to petty insults in an area where you have no expertise. And he said, I'd rather be descended from an ape than, in some sense, compromise my intellectual principles to make a point. And this was a huge furore. Huxley was concluded to have won it. And in fact, there's a lot of controversy about whether or not that was true. But nevertheless, so this book is published to great acclaim, basically. By the 1870s, most people believe in the theory of evolution. But Darwin, of course, had a secret agenda. It wasn't sufficient to explain the diversity of life on Earth in terms of natural processes. He wanted to understand the place of human beings. And the far more controversial book was published in 1871, and that was The Descent of Man. And that's the book where Darwin says, not only can nature be understood scientifically, but human beings themselves can be understood scientifically and originated in animal forms that were not themselves human.
And that was the really the debate that in some circles is still going on today.
That's the debate that in some circles is still going on today. And in particular, because Darwin didn't stop there, you know, he really was a social revolutionary. He said not only are the physical characteristics of human beings, can they be understood in terms of our animal ancestors, in some sense, but also our moral instincts. And in that he was following on David Hume, who had earlier argued philosophically that we are continuous with the rest of nature in our fundamental likes and dislikes, and even in our proto-moral systems, or in their proto-moral systems. So Darwin was the word humanist always upsets me because it's a misnomer. He was an animalist or something. He was much broader than that. Darwin's ethical principle extended to all of life. That's partly why he's so important to us, because he explains to us how it is that we relate to the rest of nature, that we're continuous with the rest of nature. And Darwin campaigned for anti-slavery campaigns. He campaigned for the rights of women. He campaigned on behalf of animals. So he was a fundamentally good person who took his theories seriously. So when you asked about the application of evolutionary theory, one of the good applications of evolutionary theory, in addition to treating diseases and understanding our history, is to give us, to provide a justification for ethical principles that lead us to be more inclusive, to treat the rest of animate nature better than we do.
Which is something that we could probably use right now just in terms of preserving ourselves and the species around us.
I think you're right. And of course, the downside was that some people took from Darwinism the wrong conclusion, and what became eugenics, what became social Darwinism. And this was the misapplication of Darwinian principles to human society based on an incomplete understanding of genetics.
What were those principles and what was mistaken about them?
Well, this was the idea that fundamentally, I guess the names that you would associate with this movement would be people like Herbert Spencer and Galton, who was Darwin's cousin. And they basically believed that if natural selection was responsible for creating order, a perfect order, so if you want to understand the perfection of the eye over countless generations interacting with the environment, you get the perfect eye, then if the idea can be extended to moral sentiments, and perhaps to intelligence, then what we should not be doing is helping individuals who are not as gifted. What we ought to be doing is selectively breeding individuals who are more gifted. And this was the idea that Spencer and Galton suggested.
And that was the same era when dog breeding became a really huge thing.
Absolutely. I mean, everything was being bred. I mean, so it was already in the air. I mean, in fact, to be fair, Herbert Spencer had these ideas before Darwin had published The Origin of Species. They were already suggesting that human beings should be selectively bred. And this is something that Darwin railed against for all sorts of reasons. One is because the genetic basis of the differences were very poorly understood. It's not clear at all that they had a solid genetic basis at the time. It's not even clear now.
Were genes even understood at that
time? Genes were not understood at all. And we can talk about that. That's very interesting in itself. It wasn't clear what intelligence was. It's still not clear what intelligence is. So it's not like breeding a dog to be larger or smaller. So all of the factors that went into making the Darwinian account so plausible were not present when it came to social systems. And it's not even clear that a social system is anything like an organism. And so all sorts of metaphors and analogies were put into play that made Darwin feel very uncomfortable. And so he never said anything about social Darwinism.
The number is 428-1393. Just taking a quick break to let people know about the KSFR pledge drive. If we reach $1,000 during this hour, we will get another $1,000 from a very generous donor. So please make your call now. So this theory that arose in Victorian England, although in a person's mind who was traveling on a boat far, far away, does it show its Victorian cultural roots in any way?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, so in some sense, yes. So this was a period of revolution, revolutionary social change. It was the period of the Industrial Revolution when new mechanical theories were starting to become very popular. You know, this was a society of incredible uneven distributions of wealth. huge amounts of competition. And so there's been a lot of work on the cultural factors that fed the idea. And so, yes, it is. But as we'll discuss tonight at this event, you'll see that the theory is very modified now.
Right.
People don't realize when we talk about Darwinian theory now that we're not really talking about the theory that's 150 years old. You know, we're talking about a whole new set of concepts that have been developed in mathematics and computer models that in many ways undermine the Darwinian dynamic that Darwin described in The Origin of Species.
And let's get into that in a moment. Mm-hmm. I have often found it striking how, well, two things. One is how much of a parallel there is in the language of evolutionary theory and in the language of free market capitalism. Looking for opportunities and niches and survival and all those things. And what happens is, I think in society, people who are advocates of free market capitalism are, whether it's conscious or not, using their understanding of Darwinian theory to basically say that capitalism is a naturally arising phenomenon like an ecosystem.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. It's worth bearing in mind there are all sorts of parallels here. Some of them are real. I mean, so Adam Smith, in The Wealth of Nations, describes the invisible hand. That is, a system can become organized through local competition between economic agents.
Exactly.
And that is like natural selection. And so it's interesting, I looked into that, and there's not a great deal of evidence to suggest that Darwin was reading Adam Smith. But clearly Adam Smith was there, he's in the culture. So there is a genuine correspondence between free market ideas and natural selection. At the same time, as you say, there are very seductive metaphors. And so, and in science, that's something that we have to avoid like the plague.
And so to speak.
So to speak. And so, yes, exactly. That was a bit of reflexivity there. So, you know, to what extent can we speak about a body as an economy of nature? I think there are ways in which you can do it. In fact, you'll hear, I think, this evening from Eric Smith, when he discusses economic theory in light of Darwinian thinking, the ideas where that's in some sense legitimate and cases where they're not.
So what are some of the ways that Darwinian theory has been updated? And let's maybe talk about some of the areas that you'll be discussing tonight.
Okay, so this evening we're going to explore, I think, four of, I think, arguably the most important issues that face us today. Issues of ecology, sustainability, the natural environment, issues of disease, HIV, tuberculosis, the stability of society, notions of conflict and war, and the economy, which I needn't speak about. And so these are four fundamentally important areas. I would argue that these are far more important than many of the areas that are being researched, say, for example, in fundamental physics. So we spend a lot of money on, say, the Large Hadron Collider, which is a very important set of experiments to investigate the fundamental particles of physical reality. And we spend far less money on the Santa Fe Institute, for example, that investigates ecology, disease, society, and economics, which I think are the most pressing things for us to understand. So those will be the four areas. Now, just discuss how we've moved beyond Darwin a little bit. These are going to be the four topics or topic areas that we're going to discuss. And I would stress that one of the things that makes a Santa Fe Institute approach to these problems a little different is that we consider all of these topics, ecology, disease, society, economics, as being coupled. You can't separate them. I mean, we've grown up in a world that's unbelievably siloed and stovepiped, where the disciplines look as if they're independent, but they're not. And part of our charge is to try and understand the complex ways in which they're interconnected. So I wanted to go back and just say, look, how did Darwin deal with some of these issues? I mean,
well, Darwin raised questions about his own theory, just as people after him have.
That's right. And so Darwin, one of the remarkable things about Darwin that demonstrates that he was really a true scientist is that one huge chapter, in fact, arguably the most interesting chapter in The Origin of Species, is called Problems with the Theory, where he just says, you know, these are all the things that I don't understand and that, in fact, could completely undermine it. And perhaps the best known was his work on what we now call the eusocial insects, things like ants and termites and wasps and bees, where there are sterile castes. So if you think about the Darwinian theory, it's all about out-reproducing a competitor. And yet here are these species where huge numbers of individuals don't even reproduce at all. And so it was a problem for Darwin. He pointed it out. He said, you know, this is the observation that could destroy my theory. And he did have a kind of answer to it. He said something like, you know, if you think about the productivity of the entire nest or the entire colony, if some individuals forfeit reproduction, but forfeit it by making a large contribution to the colony's success, then perhaps that will outweigh the costs. And in fact, that is correct. That became, in the 1960s and 70s, the theory of kin selection and group selection that some of my colleagues, namely Sam Bowles, for example, at the Santa Fe Institute, works on.
And so it's about survival, but not of the individual, rather the group.
Exactly. And so what Darwin had a glimmering of, but because he didn't understand heredity, there wasn't yet a concept of the gene in Darwin's time, he didn't really fully provide the solution to the problem. But in the 1960s and 70s, we got there. And it was basically the understanding that genes or genomes are shared, and you share more genes with closer relatives. And so the one way of getting your genes back into the population is to sacrifice yourself for a lot of other individuals that carry the same genes. And that theory took, you know, almost 100 years to arise after Darwin. And so Darwin was, you know, skating on very thin ice with that observation, which he made explicit in his own book. And so that's really the origin of complex social systems in social insects. And of course, Ed Wilson in 1975 wrote a very famous and controversial book called Sociobiology,
right,
where he claimed that those kinds of arguments, that altruism, cooperation, forfeiting reproductive gains, could be understood in human society the way we understand them in the society of insects. And until this day, that remains a highly controversial position. Although I think most of us believe there's some truth in it, we also believe it's wildly exaggerated.
So let's go back to this question. Darwin had challenges to his own theory, but there have been many others that are relevant to the topics that you will be speaking about, that the five of you will be speaking about tonight.
Yeah, so that one was really about society, and Jessica Flack tonight will discuss modern theories of social systems based both on Darwinian and post-Darwinian principles. Another one that came up that was contemporary with Darwin was this idea that somehow there hadn't been enough time for life, complex forms of life, to evolve on Earth unassisted by a divine creator. And this criticism came from an extremely smart physicist, Lord Kelvin, who calculated, based on something called the Fourier heat equation, it's a so-called diffusion equation, that if the Earth was cooling from a molten mass, and the Earth increases by 1 degree Fahrenheit for every 50 foot that you're closer to the core, the Earth would be at maximum about 100 million years old. And of course, and this was a problem. This was a huge problem because Kelvin was being rigorous, he was being scientific, he was using mathematical models, and Darwin was stuck. But fortunately, and of course the problem being, you know, if you look at complex forms of life, look how long it takes for a mountain range to come into existence. It seems to take a hell of a lot longer than tens or hundreds of millions of years. So it seemed as if there hadn't been enough time, given the age of the Earth, for life to have evolved. But Kelvin had neglected. He knew nothing about radioactivity. He knew nothing about the convection of the mantle, nothing about the fluid mantle. And so when those factors were taken into account, the Earth was calculated to be approximately 4 to 4.5 billion years old. So even though Kelvin was wrong, based on his current theories, on the contemporary theories, and they were a serious challenge to Darwin, we now know that the Earth is probably old enough for life to come into existence. And so, but that raises a whole set of very general problems, and that is, we do not have, and I think it would be an honest statement, a good idea yet of how long it takes for complex life to come into existence. Even though Kelvin's particular criticism is wrong, a good scientist would tell you, we don't know. We don't have a formula that will say, you know what, you can get life in 752.3 million years. We don't have such a formula. In fact, that's one of the challenges that we work on at the Institute. Can we try and estimate how long it might take for life to come into existence?
We're talking to David Krakauer from the Santa Fe Institute. So that particular question, how does it bear on the questions of infectious disease and ecology and so on?
Well, okay, so that's interesting because time is precisely what we don't have with viruses. Viruses are very, very rapidly evolving lineages. They evolve much more quickly than we do. They have thousands of millions of generation turnovers within our single lifetime. And so when we are sort of we stand in relation to viruses in the way the Earth does in relation to life, where a relatively slowly changing geological artifact or structure that they're evolving to. And so one issue with the evolutionary dynamic of disease is, will we ever be able to defeat it? Will we ever be able to be free of it? Because in some sense, they're always going to be winning the evolutionary arms race.
Just because time is on their side.
Time is on their side. And so one of the things that happened miraculously in the evolution of life, wasn't miraculous, of course, it was that's a metaphor, is that we evolved an adaptive immune system. We evolved an immune system that actually is a Darwinian process during our lifetime. So when we generate our immune cells, B cells and T cells, those cells are in fact generated a little bit like the pathogens that they're combating. So they replicate and divide and generate variability that's heritable in much the same way that we generate offspring that vary from us. So the immune system solved partly the problem of the separation of time scales between viruses and their hosts by inventing a very fast evolving immune system.
Very interesting. We don't have a whole lot of time to go into. We just have a couple of minutes left. What do you want to leave our listeners with? We can, of course, hear much more about all of this tonight at the lecture at 7:30 at the James A. Little Theater.
I think for me, perhaps the most important thing to understand is that scientists love mysteries. When Richard Feynman was asked, what's the greatest general lesson that science can teach culture? He said, it's to learn to live with uncertainty. Darwin's theory is only a theory, but it explains a huge amount of empirical regularity, and it does better than anything else we have. We're firmly committed to overturning it. I mean, all of us are total megalomaniacs. I mean, our dream is to prove that Darwin was wrong and replace it with something better. And so I think that
Hang on. Are you really committed to proving that he's wrong or proving that some parts of it are wrong and having a theory that encompasses that and other things? I mean, Newton wasn't wrong. He just wasn't complete. I mean, is it...
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think both... You could argue both. I think it would be even... Look, there's much that Darwin's theory can do, like Newton's theory can do. But a great theory would come along that would explain everything that Darwin explained and more and be fundamentally different. So in some sense, that really would be a coup.
So when you do that, are you going to come on the show?
Right. Maybe five of us will come on the show. We're collaborative. We come up with theories together. So I think that's the meta message, that science is about living with uncertainty and that these great theories open up new mysteries, solvable mysteries. That's a critical point. Mysteries that we can solve based on empirical observation, experiment, mathematical models, computer models.
Why do you think people seek certainty? Are we biologically programmed, so to speak, to do so?
You know, I have to say, this is something that we don't study, and it seems to me, I often wonder about this, in the same way that there are some people who hate maths and love literature, and that seems to be about people who like particulars versus people who like generalities. It seems that there seems to be another axis where on the one end there are those who like certainty and those who enjoy uncertainty. And I increasingly believe it's a psychological type, a psychological disposition. It doesn't mean it can't be changed. But it seems to me education should be about shifting people to live in that side of the spectrum, which is about being happy to live with uncertainty.
David Krakauer is a scientist at the Santa Fe Institute. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me, and thank you to Public Radio. It's great.